Welcome to the Intelligence Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos.
The National Reconnaissance Office has been acquiring a series of commercial imagery study contracts, with the latest a contract for hyperspectral imaging. The studies could lead to new approaches to imagery and image analysis. Here with details of what's going on, the director of the Commercial Systems Program Office, Pete Mund. Mr. Mund, good to have you on.
Thank you very much, Tom.
So, first of all, give us a little bit of the background on the NRO itself. I think people like me sometimes mistakenly confuse you with the NGA, but you're actually quite a deal apart, aren't you?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to do that. So the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, is an IC element, an intelligence community element, and Department of Defense agency. And we're focused on delivering innovative ISR, that's intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities, to national decision makers, the intelligence community folks, as well as warfighters, specifically with overhead reconnaissance capabilities. And so what we do on a day-to-day basis is do research and development, build, launch, and operate the nation's eyes and ears in space, really.
Some of the things that you have in space then could feed data to the NGA and other agencies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. The whole variety of intelligence community agencies, as well as the broader Department of Defense and, in many cases, the Federal Civilian Service as well.
Okay, this latest contract is for hyperspectral imaging studies. Let's get to the bigger question of studies. What is it you're actually buying here?
Well, they are study contracts, and so we are buying, I'll say, a better understanding of what the commercial industry and the commercial vendors can provide that we could support. So, as I said, we do develop a variety of national satellites, national imagery, and signals intelligence satellites to pursue the hard targets and missions that we have day to day. But the commercial industry is increasingly able to provide a good bit of value to us as well. And so what we're trying to do is get a better understanding of what's available in the marketplace and how it might meet our needs.
And things flying overhead looking and gathering data and image about the Earth, or I guess maybe things beyond the Earth, it's not just photography, is it? When you talk about hyperspectral and different things, it's really sensors looking at all parts of the electromagnetic spectrum and not just light?
Yes, it is. You know, obviously, we have a long history dealing with more traditional, I'll say, electro-optical sensors. Those are the sort of images that you may see from your cell phones or your cameras. We've been doing that for many, many years, both on the national side and, of course, commercially as well. But hyperspectral is a little bit different. It allows you to take a little bit different view of the spectra of materials and the sort of things that it's looking at, and really get a fingerprint of what you're looking at. To try to tell some material properties and those sort of things. All things that very obviously could provide value, trying to ferret out the details that we're trying to find.
What is a hyperspectral image exactly?
Well, in many cases, it's really a data cube. It's oftentimes not a literal image. It's not something that you could pull up and make sense of yourself, but it is a set of signatures of the sort of things that you're looking at. And it requires a lot of very specialized expertise to look at, if not automated intelligence and machine learning as well.
Now, this contract with a company called High Spec IQ, what is the deliverable? What do you expect to get from them?
Well, the contract with High Spec IQ, as well as our other study contracts with Maxar, Digital Globe, Planet, and Black Sky, is really to assess how these companies could provide value, meeting the needs that we have. We have a very good understanding of the needs that we have, and our overall approach is to survey the you know, what these companies can bring to bear, where they could provide value, and where they can, we really do want to be able to buy those capabilities. And then, of course, only build national systems on our side where we need to chase those even more hard and elusive targets. So so what we're really trying to assess is the extent of their capability, what they can provide, how they can provide it, understand the various performance dimensions of it, and really try to assess how it would provide value to us.
We're speaking with Pete Mund. He's director of the Commercial Systems Program Office at the National Reconnaissance Office. Are these non-traditional types of vendors that you haven't done business with before that you have found might be doing some interesting things commercially and you're trying to adopt that?
Yeah, so overall, you know, we do take a broad look across the U.S. domestic remote sensing industry, you know, leveraging our longstanding relationships with some of the vendors out there, some of the companies that are providing value for many, many years. But also, you know, there's a whole slew of emerging companies that are coming to bear that that really are offering some really exciting capabilities. And that is one of the things that we're concentrating on, is making sure we can really leverage all of those innovations that are coming to the marketplace.
So you're really writing a chapter in this overall DoD intelligence community drive to get more innovation from companies that maybe you haven't done business with before that nobody heard of until now.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's exactly what we need to be doing.
And you decided to go the contract route, that is to find out the capabilities, and then so there's the possibility that there could be a deliverable of product once the study shows that this could have efficacy?
Yes, of course. You know, understanding is really the first step, but what we want to ultimately provide is operational capability to meet our day-to-day mission needs. And so where this is heading is once we do have that better understanding of what the various companies can provide, we want to establish operational contracts and buy those images, buy those products in support of our day-to-day mission.
And if you approach a company like this, I don't know anything about high-spec IQ, but suppose you call them and say they're doing work for mining or shipping, whatever it is they do work for, what's the reaction when, hey, we're the NRO and we're top secret, a lot of what we do, and we'd like to have you come in and talk to us as the federal government? Do you get a favorable response, or do they say, well, tell us more?
I would say it varies. Some are a little bit more reticent than others, but by and large, they all do come around and are very, frankly, very open to establishing those sort of relationships. Because we are certainly the federal government. We have some really important missions, and I think by and large, the companies that we interact with are very receptive to that. We do pay attention, and we want to make sure that these companies aren't just being responsive to only the government. We know how to develop systems that are solely responsive to our needs. That's not what we're trying to do here. So we really are trying to leverage the capital efficiencies of what these companies can bring to bear and be one of those customers alongside the other mining companies and the other market verticals that they're trying to address as well.
And do these companies have their own assets up above looking down, or do they in turn buy data from other sources that do have satellites but just take a different take on that data?
No, these companies generally do have satellites, satellites that they own and operate and provide product of, and we're one of the customers looking to leverage that. And I think that's a great leverage into the general sorts of roles and responsibilities that we have across the intelligence communities. Not only does the NRO buy imagery, and we're the primary acquirer of imagery and pixels for the IC and DoD, and frankly across the broader federal civil agencies as well. But we work very, very closely with the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, who really sets the requirements. They dictate and assess what we should be looking at and look at the product itself. And frankly, they also have a broader role in consuming and procuring commercial analytics. So when you climb that value chain, whereas we're focused on providing pictures either from a national or a commercial system, they're really lead in making sure that they can acquire those commercial analytics where they can provide value.
And I just had one detail question on this, because this is really fascinating. The release says hyperspectral imaging collects many different colors of light. Any given object will have a unique signature. And it says that you can get information about each pixel in an image. I don't understand how a pixel can have more than one color in it, or maybe I don't understand pixels.
Well, one of the simpler ways of thinking about that is when you look at a color, a lot of times that's broken down into a component of red, green, or blue. And it's by mixing and varying the extent of those colors, you get a different color out of that. Now, just imagine that multiplied by many, many times, orders of magnitudes beyond that, and you can start to develop a spectra, kind of a fingerprint of what's underpinning that spot on the Earth. And it's through understanding that fingerprint you can start to ferret out some of the unique material properties of what you're looking at.
I guess the increasing resolution of the views from space really enable this type of technology.
Yeah, resolution is a big part of it. There's been a tremendous amount of innovation that the commercial industry is able to bring to bear, not only in terms of the miniaturization of microelectronics, the advent of cloud computing, and the sorts of automated intelligence that you can layer on top of that at scale and, frankly, with a very low barrier to entry. And then also one of the most important parts is the decreasing barrier to entry in terms of access to space. Just the cost of getting a pound of payload into orbit is decreasing dramatically. So I think all that really enables new and different business opportunities to really explore and seek out new ways of providing value. And frankly, it's those same sort of things that are also driving really increased innovation on our side as well for the sort of things that that we build on our side. We're building a very, I'll say, hybrid architecture of not only larger systems but small systems as well, like the CubeSats that we just launched on one of the NASA missions. And I think through leveraging all those different innovations, we are really being able to address a new generation of difficult problems.
Peter Meund is director of the Commercial Systems Program Office at the National Reconnaissance Office. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you very much.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive at Apple Podcasts or Podcast One.
From idea to reality. Innovation is at the heart of mission success. At Leidos, we're helping our customers transform vast amounts of data into actionable intelligence. Leidos is number one on the Washington Technology Top 100, bringing unrivaled talent to bear on the intelligence community's critical missions through our data analytics, all-source analysis, linguistics, agile and SecDevOps, and advanced AI/ML that allows you to see the full picture faster. At Leidos, the important work never stops. Visit leidos.com/intel to learn how.
The National Security Agency is a month into an annual exercise that'll run until early January. It's the Codebreaker Challenge, a way to identify and encourage U.S. undergrads and graduate students interested in cybersecurity in service of national security. Here from the NSA with the latest, Kathy Hudson, Senior Strategist for Academic Engagement. Ms. Hudson, good to have you on.
Thanks. It's great to be with you today.
And Eric Bryant, Technical Director for the Crypto Analysis Organization. Mr. Bryant, good to have you on.
Great. Thanks to be here, Tom.
All right. Tell us the background here. What is the annual Codebreaker Challenge and what happens during it? Ms. Hudson?
Well, the annual Codebreaker Challenge is something actually that Eric and his team initially came up with the concept in 2013. It was a way now to be able to communicate with academia on some of the areas we thought were important that they include in their curriculum. For example, reverse engineering. It was also a way to showcase some of the real-world challenges that NSA was facing and be able to launch it out there nationwide for students across the spectrum to be able to test their talents.
Eric, how does it work?
Right. So the way it works is we have a website, codebreaker.ltsnet.net, and so students go to the website, they register for the challenge, and then on the main page we have there's some background material that describes the scenario for the year, and then there's a series of tasks that they work through. They start off a little bit easier, and then it gets progressively more difficult to the point where the final task is usually something that would be challenging to an existing expert in the field. But each of the tasks are related and would be real-life things that, the type of work that we would do here at NSA if we were working on that type of problem.
Well, give us an example of a task. Is it something you do at a keyboard, looking at a screen?
Right. So in the storyline, so in this year's challenge, for example, which is a secure messaging app that runs on Android, there are different objectives. So using this year as sort of the example, students are working towards building a couple different capabilities. One is to be able to masquerade as the terrorists that are using this application. Another is to be able to send spoof messages. And then ultimately, the final task is to break all of the encryption. So one of the tasks would be reverse engineer the app and find a way to be able to masquerade as a terrorist without actually knowing their login credentials. And so as part of that task, they're going to be using tools like Ghidra, which the NSA open sourced earlier this year, to look at the underlying app code and try to find a vulnerability or a way in which they could subvert the security mechanisms.
Sure.
And so in that case, they're going to be interacting with our servers that we're running and try to ultimately achieve those objectives.
So it sounds a little bit different than a black hat, white hat type of exercise. It's more of you're stuck in a room and try to find the way out sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's it's pretty interesting because I think the we have some dialogue that goes along with each of the tasks, in terms of like how we recovered the information and what we're trying to do. But there, ultimately, the technical work they do is, exactly like the sort of things that, we would be interested in.
Sure. And Kathy, what are some of the ways that you get the word out to the academic institutions, and what sorts of colleges and universities tend to participate?
So we are fortunate at NSA. We have a group of academic liaisons. And so those are NSA employees who are assigned a school, and they work to assist professors and deans as they're building curriculum and they're influencing curriculum. And they are also responsible for communicating to the schools things like our hiring requirements for the year, articulating key deadlines for our student program applications, as well as pushing out the word with regard to specific things that are unique to NSA, such as our annual cybersecurity and cryptanalysis challenge, which is Codebreaker. Also, for example, the release of Ghidra that happened this past year. So they are pushing all this information out to the various academic institutions that we are very much interested in that are teaching now and awarding degrees that are really aligned with our key mission requirements here at NSA. In addition to that, we have a professor serving on sabbatical here at the agency, and so we're providing them updates on information as well so they can, push it back out into their appropriate change as well. And it's fabulous because we've had longstanding relationships with many, many of the schools, and so they are eagerly anticipating Codebreaker now every year. In fact, I think Eric gets all kind of fan mail. When's it coming? Can you give us a hint about what it's going to be? What it's going to be this year? So it has really built up a fan club, I would say, of its own. So that's great because it grows on itself that way as well.
Kathy Hudson is senior strategist for academic engagement, and Eric Bryant is technical director of the Crypto Analysis Organization. I'm Tom Temin.
From idea to reality, innovation is at the heart of mission success. At Leidos, we're helping our customers transform vast amounts of data into actionable intelligence. Leidos is number one on the Washington Technology Top 100, bringing unrivaled talent to bear on the intelligence community's critical missions through our data analytics, all-source analysis, linguistics, agile and SecDevOps, and advanced AI/ML that allows you to see the full picture faster. At Leidos, the important work never stops. Visit leidos.com/intel to learn how.
We're speaking with Kathy Hudson, senior strategist for academic engagement, and Eric Bryant, technical director of the Crypto Analysis Organization, both at the National Security Agency. And I have to say, Eric, Crypto Analysis Organization sounds like the best title I've heard in government. And what are the metrics for measuring how well people do and what happens to the best of the code breakers?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. So part of what goes into designing the challenge is, for us to kind of assess the difficulty of each task and what skills, that would be required to solve it. We try to make the early tasks accessible to those without any prior cybersecurity experience. So that way, people, it's a great learning opportunity. They may not know exactly how to solve everything right away, but if they work at it, they can get through at least the early tasks. But then, we want those tasks to get progressively more difficult to the end be, a significant achievement to solve all of them. And so typically less than 1% of students are able to solve everything. And if you look at the leaderboard on the site, you'll see a kind of a steady drop off in terms of the number of solutions as the tasks get more and more complex. But as, as students get far in the challenge, that's where, we'll have direct outreach to those students, encourage them to, keep up the good work. But also, if any of them are interested in coming to work at NSA, then that provides an opportunity for us to, tell them about various job opportunities and how to go about applying and submitting their application online.
And do you have any sense of how many people have actually entered the agency as the result of participating in Codebreaker?
Quite a few. I don't have an exact number, but that number is definitely, I would say, steadily growing. And one thing we've seen over the past couple of years is more and more, in particular the students that get really far that are applying and coming into, you know, our intern co-op programs as well as full-time hires. I think one of the things that Codebreaker helps highlight is in these applicants is really two different dimensions. One is, of course, just raw talent to be able to solve everything. But also it's a large time commitment to work on this. And these students are all working on the challenge in addition to their regular school duties. And so I think when you have somebody that's willing to commit that kind of time, it also shows a genuine interest in the topic matter. And I think those two things combined is you know, pretty powerful.
And if someone were to participate in Codebreaker with the eye toward maybe working for the NSA, what are some of the other background requirements that you have to keep in mind if you want to work in an agency like NSA? Kathy?
I would say if somebody is interested in working at the agency, I would suggest that they go to intelligencecareers.gov, and that provides lots of information on jobs that are available, what are the qualifications for the jobs, as well as what the processing is in order to get the security clearance that we carry here at NSA, because there's special processing around that. And I think it's always good for students to go look to see to make sure, hey, I'm making good decisions, I'm behaving smartly, and maybe if they haven't to date, because we were all in college at one time and enjoying our schoolwork as well as enjoying life, it is great for them to say or be thinking, huh, maybe I need to make a couple changes so that I can ensure that I can process for a clearance.
Yeah, well, that's a really, you know, the clearance process is the main you know, one of the main hurdles to getting in. And so assuming they meet all the requirements for that, like Kathy was outlining, then certainly working on a task like Codebreaker helps the other dimension, which is, of course, you know, that they are a good candidate from a technical and personal perspective. So.
Sure, and I guess you have to get used to working in an environment where you can't check your smartphone every 5 seconds. But
yeah.
is it possible
well,
to...
That's true.
Yeah.
But there, you know, as you know, there is some great freedom in that, right? Because when you do walk out of the doors at work, everything stays in the building. And so you get to go home and your cell phone isn't going off with lots of work-related issues or challenges. So it does somewhat provide that separation between work and life, is what I always tell the students.
Detail question. Is it possible for someone to get hired and do non-classified related work while their security clearance comes through?
Oh, while they're processing for a security clearance. I would say not exactly at this time, at least not for the National Security Agency. So in order for you to be an NSA employee and enter on duty and to receive your proper credentials in order to work here, you have to have completed the process. So we don't have a capability right now for people who are kind of in that still processing world to do unclassified work for us yet. But there are some considerations for possibly doing something like that in the future.
Kathy Hudson is Senior Strategist for Academic Engagement. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me today.
And Eric Bryant is Technical Director of the Crypto Analysis Organization. Thank you also.
Thank you, Tom.
And they're both with the National Security Agency. Find this interview and a link to more information at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive at Apple Podcasts or Podcast One.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligence Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.